Hello, and welcome to episode 86 of the Sci-Fi Podcast from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm Nick Soutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Sarah Robbins, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Kansas. Sarah's research is focused primarily on memory, through which she discusses a range of issues in philosophy of mind, psychology, and neuroscience. Sarah is particularly interested in the concept of the memory trace, or engram, and the role it plays in both everyday and scientific thinking about remembering. The idea that remembering involves an engram becoming stable and permanent via consolidation has guided the neuroscience of memory since its inception. The shift to thinking of memory as continuous and dynamic as part of a trend toward neural dynamics has challenged this commitment, with some calling for the demise of the fixed trace and others urging rejection of the consolidation dogma. In this regard, Sarah argues that consideration of neural dynamics does not provide reasons to reject engram theory, and in fact, they are compatible. At most, shifting to a dynamic view of neural processes compels revision of the implementational details of memory. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Sarah. Dr. Sarah Robbins, welcome to the Sci-Fi Podcast. How are you this Friday morning?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm great. It's nice to be here. So, yeah.
Great. How are things at the University of Kansas?
They are good. It is like the first day of fall that feels like fall here. It's the first time it's below 80 degrees, so it feels genuinely like a fall day at college. Overall, things are going very well. I think at the moment, it's because people here are very excited about football, which is not something people here spend time excited about. It's not really my form of excitement, but
Collegially. Right. So, but in some ways, like it creates, even if you're not into football, I imagine it creates, there's this sense of energy from the crowds and just a general sense on campus. And sometimes even if you don't like that, that can transfer into like, I don't know, enthusiasm in classes. If the team's doing well, like people are going to be excited to show up, you know, the undergrads and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I say this not as a like anti-sports snob, but as a basketball snob. And so
there it is. Of course. Well, you're Kansas. So it's
Kansas. So right.
Oh, wow. And so I was just looking, I hadn't looked at the rankings for a while. And so, yeah, you are, Kansas is a top 25 team in football, which
is for the first time in maybe two decades. So I figured it out officially yesterday that they've won more games so far this year. This is my 10th year at KU than the previous nine seasons combined. So they've been building towards it, I'm led to understand. But so there's a lot of, and I think college game day is here, which I know about when it happens for basketball. So it is mayhem here.
Wow.
I'm actually in my home office. So, but in part because campus is very loud today.
So the thought is, so for those of you, for most of the people, I think I don't want to say they don't, or maybe that familiar with these kinds of things. But for example, being in the top 25 in football is like an incredible accomplishment for an athletics department, considering there's thousands of universities. Generally speaking, it's very difficult to have multiple revenue athletes. So like football and basketball are known as like revenue sports. They're athletics. So there's obviously things like soccer, track and field, things like that. There's athletics, but like to have multiple revenue sports highly ranked is like an extremely difficult accomplishment by a university. I also went to an undergraduate where University of Arizona, where basketball was like really big. And football was not good at all just because like you could only really. Yeah. And then there's school, you know, there's programs like, I don't know, Wisconsin or something or maybe Ohio State. No, usually you pick one. Usually it's like you're usually just good at one for the most part. That's interesting to me. And then also the college game day thing is, what is it like a national? It's like every week it goes to a new venue and they have essentially live reporting and coverage of a very big game or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's a kind of incentive for everyone to be, did we break up?
No, I'm still here.
Yeah, it's a big opportunity to display a lot of fandom very publicly.
Fair enough. So it's
gearing up costume wise, it seems like around campus. So.
Well, it looks like both teams are undefeated. You're the Jayhawks, and there's the TCU Horned Frogs. So this would be good if Kansas can pull out a victory, they will be in the next. Anyway, wow, that's the most I've talked about sports on this podcast. I don't think I've like ever, very, very, very briefly. But
and it's football, which just hurts my soul. But
I'm sorry about that. I always pick Kansas in the NCAA bracket. Kansas is usually, I don't know, I'm sure like in certain brackets I pick them to win. And hopefully, yeah, I'm excited. Yeah, hopefully we can see some really cool things going on for the basketball. It's going to be exciting. So we just hopped on a call right before we started this, and you mentioned you were there was a really good a talk from a colleague regarding some of your well on the topic with which you work, philosophy of memory. How was the talk this morning?
It was a fantastic talk. So it was David Colasso, who's currently a postdoc in Munich, and he was talking about some of his work on the history of the phenomenon of memory transfer. So it's a rich project in the kind of in history and philosophy of science on this very controversial set of findings, where they're sort of in part because the central scientific figure was a bit. It sort of was known for being the kind of provocateur about the work that he was doing. But it also sort of, there's really interesting questions about whether it's a viable phenomenon. This involved this is his story to tell, but yeah, taking worms and giving them memories and then seeing if you can get those memories to go forward in future, if you can transfer those memories to other
memory worms. Transfer, right.
Yeah, exactly. So the kind of sci-fi style thing, but it looks like, it's a helpful thing for a philosopher to say, in the end, half of the legitimacy of that program is what you mean by memory, right? So thinking about what exactly it means to transfer certain mechanisms and exhibit certain behaviors, those kinds of questions are really sort of fundamental ones behind the evaluation of that framework. So, so it was a really fun conversation.
Great. Well, I'm excited to hear. So, I've known David briefly, and then I've also, in following him, have become familiar with other philosophers of memory like yourself and others. So there's this, and have seen like panels and workshops and even beyond symposiums, like working groups on philosophy of memory at the PSA, and I imagine like abroad seeing like positions. And so I'm really excited to hear like what is this particular field, a little bit of the history of this subspecialty in philosophy of science, how it relates, how it connects with obviously related things into philosophy of mind, cognitive science, and then the sciences in general, psychology, of neuroscience, things like that. So before we get into that, why don't we take a step back and learn a little bit about you, Sarah, and your little bit about history, how you got into philosophy of science to begin with. So Sarah, tell us, where did you grow up?
I grew up actually in Kansas, where I am now.
So
a couple hours from here. So it's in small, mostly in one single small town, but in small towns in this area. So it is, in many ways, very nice to be back here. It's also very strange to be back in this part of the world in a permanent way, which is not, when you go to
graduate school, back to visit.
Exactly. You don't really see yourself as returning someplace near where you started. So, I don't have a family with a background in higher ed in this way. And so when I was going to graduate school, a lot of them were trying to make sense of that. And they were, they said, right. Like, oh, so that means you'll teach at the University of Kansas someday? And I was like, no, it doesn't work.
No, it likely means I have to move where I don't have any control over, actually. And I just have to go where, you know, it's kind of like joining the military or something. I don't know.
Right. So I told them that story. They refused to believe that was true. And then I got the job here. And so I get a lot of I told you so's that I just have to, you know, I'm very fortunate.
I told you where you'd come back. You're like, yeah, okay. You don't understand how much luck got into this.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I, you know, I feel privileged and lucky. So I take it. But yeah, it's sort of funny to me.
So University of Kansas is located, you said it was, so you grew up about, you said a few hours away?
Mm-hmm, a few hours south of here. Yeah. Okay. Southeastern part of the state.
Okay. Yeah. So what were some of your interests growing up? What does someone in Kansas find themselves up to?
not a lot when you live in small towns. But I love to read. I was an avid reader, so I read a bunch, especially like, which is still a guilty pleasure of mine, like mystery novels, like every one that's ever been written. So so I did a lot of those kinds of things, and I played sports because that's what kids in Kansas do. And when I was younger, I was like determined that I was going to be some kind of doctor. And I told people that I wanted to be a psychiatrist, which I think, given everything I knew about the world at the time, was the closest I got to understanding that like I wanted to study like minds and brains. Gotcha. That's what my real, that's when I thought of what I wanted to do. It was something like that. But of course I had no idea. Like
what was it about being a psychiatrist that was kind of motivating to you?
That's a good question. I mean, I think in the sense of like the fact that I liked school and at that age and given my family background, like the only ways I understood that you could be like a smart person that kept going in school was like you were a lawyer or you were a doctor. Gotcha. And it was always the doctor-y, science-y side that was interesting to me. And so, but I also really liked, I liked biology and I liked how those sorts of things worked. I can't really remember, and now I'm very sensitive about memory claims, but I don't really remember if I knew much about brains exactly, but I always found psychology to be interesting, like from a relatively young age. Like I found, various things about how minds worked and how you could trick people's minds and, all that kind of stuff very interesting. So I don't think it had anything to do with the kind of therapeutic sense of psychiatry. I just was like, that
sounds cool. Yeah.
Minds are working in science.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting aspect also of understanding like the kinds of paths that are available to you, especially when, not connected to higher ed in this way, and like how that could potentially shape, not necessarily your interests, but at least like the available paths of exploring your interest. So, mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right. So tell us about, in thinking about medical science or psychiatry or something like that, is this something that you began to pursue, let's say at, going into university? Did you go, from high school to college? How did things work?
Yeah. So I went to college. I went to a small liberal arts school in Arkansas. This was called Hendricks College. I think I wanted to get far away from the place where I grew up, but I was very drawn to going to one of these kind of like small colleges, just not with the same small set of people I knew before. And it was a great place those kinds of colleges can be really special kind of formative.
Yeah, places. Absolutely.
And so I started out as a biology and psychology double major because I'm old enough that they were getting really interested, and I was part of some of the first classes that happened. But there was no neuroscience major. There was no that wasn't a thing. Right. So I was doing biology and I was doing psychology, and my senior year there was a cognitive neuroscience course, and it was like, awesome.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'm pretty sure it was the first time they'd offered it. That was all kind of starting in those ways at that time. But I, by my sophomore year, decided that I also wanted to do philosophy. So eventually the biology got dropped, and I ended up doing psychology and philosophy. Mostly because you couldn't have three majors, but.
So I know you've mentioned like science. Did you take a philosophy class in undergrad, or was there
Yeah. What shifted to the philosophy?
So that was my first real exposure to philosophy. There was a sequence of classes all first year students had to take that involved some philosophy. But then, and then going on to take another class or two, I really liked it. In part, I liked it because it was hard. Some of my interest in it was even prior to really seeing the intersection between philosophy and psychology. So I just enjoyed it. So I remember distinctly taking a course in early modern philosophy with someone who was, and of course they were very mind and metaphysics-y kinds of topics. But I was just sort of, I just loved it. So started taking more classes, and I was someone, and there were some pragmatic reasons in the background in that I had taken some college credits when I was in high school. And so my parents were trying, they were like, well, you could probably just finish in 3 years. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to finish in 3 years, like, because I'm also getting a philosophy major. So sort of start like that. And then once I saw the connection between philosophy and psychology for the kinds of questions I was interested in, that was sort of it for me.
Great. Okay. Right. So connecting with the philosophy, working in, Hendricks College sounds like a really cool spot. And these small liberal arts colleges, I think, can really do a great job of, shaping people, just furthering people's ability to think critically, open-mindedly. I'm glad to hear that you had a good experience.
There's actually, just as a small point of trivia, there are several philosophers who came out of there at the same time that I did. So Angela Potocnik, who's a dear friend of mine, we're best buds in college. And a few other people, another friend of ours does ancient philosophy. It is at Wake Forest now. Another one does sort of early German philosophy, and last I checked was at a small school in Maryland. And several more went to grad school and got engaged in similar projects. So we were also there at a time when, for a small place, there were a lot of people really interested in doing philosophy, and we had, great professors that were really spending time with us, letting us do that. So
great. All right. So tell us a little bit about how you came into, move forward to graduate work. So I know you mentioned that previously kind of coming up, there was, I imagine in university, this could have been, the ideas start to come, but like prior, there is this not real understanding of doing, professional philosophy in a way. How did you shift from then deciding, no medical science and psychiatry to then doing something like the graduate program that you did?
Yeah. So I when I finished, when I graduated from college, I still thought I was going to go on in psychology. So I was all set my senior year to apply to cognitive neuroscience PhD
programs. Right.
So that's what I thought. I had made the shift away from med school. And then I was like, okay, so now I want to do this new thing called cognitive neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And as I was starting the application process, it was this, especially for those kinds of programs. And at that time, which is more true in the sciences in general, you had to apply that you were going to two particular labs, right? You applied to programs, but you needed to say I want to work on visual perception with so-and-so. I want to do attention monitoring in this lab. And I was having this sort of crisis of it's all, it wasn't any one thing I wanted to do in that way. And that made me sort of realize I want to know about this research and I want to write and think about it, but I don't actually want to do that research. About the way the programs are structured helped me to think about what I would actually be doing as a cognitive neuroscience grad student. And I realized I don't want to do that.
The doing is, it's a very different kind of day to day, and it's very narrow. The practice of it doesn't mean you can't read about other kinds of things, but it's I don't know. I had a very similar experience with working in behavioral neuroscience, and it was I don't know. Yeah. It's just interesting to hear that kind of, I love learning about the science and thinking about it. The idea of then saying, I want to work in this lab on this very specific problem or with this very specific brain region. And that's all, it feels like you're saying, that's all I'm going to do. Feels constricted.
It was discovering that the program I ended up going to, that the philosophy and neuroscience psychology program at WashU was a thing. I mean, this is also the early days of programs being on the internet. like a you dinosaur.
They weren't in like a physical thing you could call for or something, like a printed.
There were printed things, but some programs were getting better and better websites. I mean, I was part of that sort of lucky generation of like everyone was trying out online applications. So half my applications I did on a typewriter, the other half I got my fees waived because I tried their new online system for submitting my things. But so that was 2003.
Wow.
And so, finding out about the PNP program was very much like, that's what I mean. So that was a program that actually involved taking courses in the sciences and doing that, but also taking courses in philosophy. Perfect. And so that made me then seek out programs like that were sort of, and of course, imperfectly, because my conception of the field was was limited. But yeah,
sure, finding sure.
Philosophy of cognitive science oriented programs was, what I went for.
Cool. All right. So what, so how was your time at the PNP program? I remember when I was first making the turn myself, behavioral neuroscience and, psychology potentially philosophy of science. I heard great things about the PNP program. So what was what was it like there? What is the overall, I would say, this isn't something I necessarily asked, like the orientation of the training, like, it's one thing to say, okay, we do you take science courses and you take the philosophy, but like maybe we can go a little bit further here and understanding like what is kind of the way they approach doing philosophy of science or encourage folks to do it. I'd be more interested in that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's so many interesting features of that there and elsewhere, both that involve like what the actual curriculum structure is like, but there's so much also too, that's about the kind of social and less formal bits of structure. While I was there on the kind of formal curriculum side, there was a real sort of debate happening in the program and in the department about what the PNP program was meant to look like, in the sense of, should you have a full proper philosophy PhD with science added on, or should you have this, which means that it takes forever to get through that program because you have to take so many courses, or should it be a program where you take less philosophy and some psychology, some psych and neuro, because, you know, you're going to be doing them as a piece. And part of it had to do with thinking like, well, where is someone who gets this training going to get a job? So for a long time, they thought, you have to have a full proper philosophy PhD and then equip like the, you know, what is effectively a master's of in like psych and neuro, because you're going to get a job in a philosophy department ultimately. And so you need to be, you know, like your philosophy credentials need to be unimpeachable in that sense. So that was the view when I started, and that was changing during my time there. But on the kind of more, it was a great place to do the sort of interaction between these fields. There's fantastic psychology and neuroscience at WashU, and the programs are physically close together. I think that matters. When I was trying to pick programs and then learning later, not all programs that like will let you do a cognitive science certificate or have some kind of connection. Sometimes they're on different campuses, right? In ways that can really affect whether the people are engaging and interacting with each other. And the philosophy and psych department and biology department at WashU are like literally, they're just one building across. They're like actually connected by a little walkway. Oh. You don't even have to go outside. And so several talks happen back and forth. They're sort of friendship, like the psych, I really liked that, you know, most of the psychology and neuroscience faculty I took courses from were perfectly accustomed to having PNP students in their courses. So, you know, we're interested in thinking about the ways that they designed assignments such that they made sense for us too at the graduate level, which was great. And I ended up actually working in a psychology lab during my time there for several years. I was sort of a proper lab member, which was great.
I think that's a really unique point. I also had some graduate training, and that where, you know, we're certainly encouraged to do masters in the science, and in certain sciences, it was familiar, but there wasn't such the tight link where you had to do a lot of lifting of community, of sometimes essentially convincing the science instructors, like that you deserve to be in the graduate course. And like, this is the way in which you could not, I mean, they're usually fine with you enrolling, but it's like to be taken, you know, like I found it sometimes struggling, like working with, yeah, just like some were much more like, oh yeah, of course, this is what we do. And then some were like, which department are you from again? Like, how is this a thing? And so hearing this kind of thing with like, I imagine instructors getting used to, okay, this is what it looks like for like philosophy students when they take the course, or this is how, you know, I think that's really unique. I think that's a really great thing. And I wish it's something I would hope that, I don't know, maybe like these kind of philosophy of science programs would, if they're there and they're expecting their students to do it, they might have some like outreach and connection. So, 'cause it's like, the, for example, like the folks that I'm now, like I've gone back and talked with them, and then they know of the department, but they've never actually spoken with the DGS or things like that. And that could be, you know, just like a phone call or emails, communicating, understanding, here's what we're encouraging our students to do. Things like that could be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think a lot of the legwork is on the part of, in these programs, in ways that people don't always realize it, like it is on the part of graduate students, right?
Sure.
And that's like, but it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's something I didn't appreciate about those programs. And I liked that for the areas I was going into, some people had already done that. And then there were several of my peers that were trying, one who was getting really interested in, you know, primate related stuff, who was going to courses in anthropology, and they weren't yet part of that, you know, group. And so at first this person was like, you know, what are you kind of, you know, what are your questions? Why, if you're from philosophy, I think the worry was that there were going to be sort of ethical questions, right? And which of course are still there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, and it was like, no, I'm genuinely interested in kind of sort of cross species, you know, cognition and things of that sort. So, it does take a lot of work, and it does pay forward for building a program.
Yeah. Well, it's helpful, but as you said, also sort of, it does teach like, because this is something you have to go on to do for your own self, you know, in your own research. And so like, this isn't going to be the first step to like working with other scientists and things like that. So it's like, it kind of teaches you in some ways, like that kind of, I don't know what you would call it. I don't know, some sort of net. I mean, it's like networking for the purpose of, it's like, yeah, for, of, yeah, it's, it, I mean, it is networking in a very broad sense, but it's different.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right, but so your program has been so very supportive, encouraging, and you know, from what I've come to learn about, it is focused very intently on memory. So, was this related to the psych lab that you ended up working in?
It wasn't. So that was part of what I thought I was originally going to do, and then I stuck with it because it was such a rich and rewarding, on many levels, sort of experience to have. But so originally, and I think it's in largely because it was the area where it looked like philosophy, one of the areas where philosophy and psychology were really working together very productively, was all of the things about theory of mind development that were sort of big topics, where there was an incredible amount of interdisciplinary collaboration between philosophers and psychologists, like in the 90s and the early 2000s. I was super interested in that stuff. So that's what I thought I was going to be writing about, was sort of the development of the mind and these kinds of folk psychology concerns. So I was working with the primary developmental psychologist at WashU at the time, who was actually sort of most properly a psycholinguist. So she was really interested in children's development of written language, which is super fascinating. I think it takes a little while to connect it to some of the philosophical issues. But she was a fantastic mentor. And I think like, psych departments are just very good at, or science in general is structured more to do a lot of training and networking. And so I really enjoyed those experiences and the kind of research project that we developed in there. And so I kept that going while I tried to figure out what my dissertation was actually, you know, what I was actually going to work on. So, you know, there was a stage where I knew that I just didn't feel like I had anything to contribute to the theory of mind debates. I was really interested in it, but I could never find, I mean, that's, I think the hard thing as a grad student sometimes is like, I love this literature. This is really fascinating, but I don't have anything to say about it. Cool. And that's cool.
We don't talk about I don't know what kind of how skill, but it's like, there's the one thing of like assessing, like, so some people are really good at jumping into like, very worked out. I think I spoke about this with another guest recently. Like, they're really good at jumping into like very worked out, like if you're jumping into like realism debates or something like that, you're just jumping into things that have like, they've been around for a long time, and then you're having to come in and have something kind of then to come in, excavate it, or like understand, and then have, you know, come up with some, have something different to say in regard to this very well explored option. Or some people, I mean, maybe this actually isn't what's going on here, but, or stepping into something else, that is, it's maybe a little more fertile and unique, and, or like probably like has a little bit more ground clearing to do, perhaps. Yeah. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case, cause I don't want to say that like theory of mind things, it sounds like it was growing in the sense. So it was a little bit of A and B in terms of being a new field, like thinking about it this way, but maybe it's just what I want to, you know, come back to that first thing of just understanding, like, one, when you're interested in something, but also two, when and if you like understanding if you do or do not have something to say, I think is a valuable tool. Or like,
And I do think for the kind of work we require of philosophers, I mean, thinking about this with you now is making me realize how much this informs how I talk to our grad students. So I'm the DGS of our program.
Oh, wonderful.
And I really do think about like the kind of prospectus moving to dissertation stage. I'm someone who advocates really strongly for like we can't send a student off into that kind of writing stage without, you know, like the clearing the prospectus until they have a result, like in the sense that, like, not in the sciencey sense, but like, knowing a literature super well, you know, and being kind of all around it is wonderful. And those are skills obviously you have to have, but I think there's a kind of confidence and clarity that you get once you've got something figured out, right? You're like, no,
I think generally, and I've seen things, I mean, this comes probably beyond even like philosophy, but like literature or things that were like the idea or the concept is almost like, it can be like very like 55% of, I don't want to say it's the majority of the work, but it's like, if you have a very novel claim or something, or I mean, just comparing it with you, like, it's not just like, okay, the topic is interesting and you can send them off to like understand it, because they might go off and understand it for a couple of years and realize, I don't know what to, you know, where's the contribution, or like, what do you, you know, and it's the contribution. It's not, I mean, it's not that learning about these things is not like futile in itself, you know, and it could direct things in terms of teaching or maybe the way it shapes your other research, but like in terms of adding a brick to the, adding things to to the body of work, like, you're right, it's probably good to sort of evaluate prospectuses, is that you at least have to have something that you're like, okay, I could see how at least maybe, you know, it depends how they're going to eventually get there, but they have to show that they've got kind of already have an end in mind, that this appears to be something that they, that is worth saying in this area. That's really good evaluation.
And it can be like a, you know, and it can be a small portion of what they'll go on to say, but I think having that thing anchors you also helps you know, I mean, for any project, I still feel this way sometimes when writing papers, but like especially when writing a dissertation, it's hard to know what is and isn't relevant, right? If you follow the things you're interested in, you can end up in some wild places. And so, you know, when you're writing a dissertation, you can't just keep doing that. So you have to know like what's relevant for what I'm interested in and not. And if you've got some kind of like, well, I know that I think, you know, X is the right move here, then that can tell you what to bring in or what not to bring in or where to go next. And so I think that really is a critical component. And so despite my interest in those things, I think retrospectively, I couldn't have described it that way at the time. I just didn't have that. And so I was really spinning my wheels in that kind of late coursework, early transition stage about what it was I was going to do.
So how did you switch? So you're taking a number of courses and things. So how did the, you know, moving toward, did you end up writing the dissertation related to theory?
I ended up writing on memory.
How did that shift happen?
Yeah. So I had gotten myself to a point that I thought I was going to write about personal and subpersonal levels of explanation in psychology. And so, which was sort of related to the theory of mind stuff. But I also, part of what wasn't working for me, I actually ended up switching advisors at that point. So I had been working with someone, and then I, like, that relationship wasn't working very well for that either. And so that was when Carl Craver became my advisor. And Carl, you know, like, didn't really care, but I mean, he was enthusiastically supportive of helping me, but like, you know, the personal subpersonal explanation was not, that's not his, you know, it's not an issue that he's got, you know, sort of
major stake in.
He's got no dog in that fight or horse in that race or whatever. And he could tell that I was spinning my wheels, and he very helpfully, I think both for that moment and for me, like professionally, said like, okay, well, so what about, he's like, I was just reading something the other day about the idea of a memory trace. And he was like, is a memory trace personal or subpersonal? Why don't you just try to go answer that question? And I was like, okay, I'll go do that. And then, I mean, it wasn't like literally the next day, but then he left and was in Germany for like 6 months, or he was on some kind of extended leave around the time that I was going to do that. And one of the first times we met, like now I don't remember whether it was like over what would have been like Skype in those days, or when it, if it was when he got back. And he was like, you know, how are things going? And I was like, well, sort of good news, bad news, because we were thinking of that might be the like first chapter, like, let's just try this stuff out. And I was like, good news, bad news, like bad news. Cause he was gone long enough. I said, I was going to try to have a draft of like all the major chapters. And so I was like, well, good news, bad news. I don't have the draft of all the chapters. But the good news is the first chapter is like 95 pages long. And he was like, okay, so it sounds like what you have is a different dissertation. You're actually trying to write a dissertation about memory instead. And I was like, is that what I'm doing? And so, yeah, so that's sort of how it got started.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. Well, tell us, okay, so why don't you, so what, maybe could you share with maybe some of your, you know, sort of the major, your major, what you ended up realizing what you had to say about memory traces or memory in general. What did he end up saying in the dissertation? Or maybe like one or two of the main points.
Yeah. So I ended up saying, I mean, at this point, I'll just say as kind of background, there was no philosophy of memory at this time. There were a couple of other people starting to do, there were a few things that had been written by kind of senior people on this topic, but not very much. And there were a few young people starting to write, but like there were literally, I mean, like a handful at most of things on the topic. And I was, so the, a kind of standard default background view in memory is this thing called the causal theory of memory, which is based on a very intuitive idea that like, if you remember, for it to be right that you say you remember your, I'm going to say sixth birthday, because today is my son's sixth birthday, right? If you remember that later, then, you know, if, you know, he got a green bike this morning. So like if you,
oh, I bet he's excited.
it's epic, as he would say.
If
you remember that later, then there has to be some way in which your current mental state is caused by that previous fact, right? Like if you genuinely remember it versus just like, you know, I don't know, inferring it from general knowledge about the world. There has to be some way in which something that happened to you when you got the bike is now operative in you thinking about it later. That's the sort of, you know, in a very philosopher's term, way of thinking about what the causal theory of memory is. And I was really interested in, and that view is kind of the default and dominant view to the extent there was anyone talking about memory. And, you know, I took a lot of classes in psychology, and the lesson from psychology is that memory is a hot mess, right? Like, you know, you think you're remembering when you're not, and all this stuff is happening. And so psychologists think, and neuroscientists were in a phase of thinking of memory as sort of wildly constructive. And so my dissertation was about like, how do you put those two things together? And what I really thought was like, I think memory is less wildly constructive than psychologists think sometimes. But I do think that you are retaining things from the past in the way the causal theory suggests, but that it can be influenced in the, by lots of other things that happen to you in various ways. So I was taking some of the famous memory error experiments and showing how they required a kind of hybrid view.
Very nice. So, I mean, so that's wonderful. And yeah, I have an experience from taking this. My only exposure to real direct memory was either a psychology of memory course, which was focusing on these like error experiments and just like more like behavioral experiments from the past phenomena, exploring like what is it. But I did remember we had to learn like memory tricks in order to resolve the memory exam. So, because this was really interesting. The exam was like, maybe it would be 30 short answer questions where some of the like very, so it was a long exam where you had to maybe even reproduce graphs from memory. And so use the memory techniques. Again, this was, you know, this isn't looking into the philosophy of memory. It was just more like, how can you explore and utilize? So it was more just like psychological like studies in terms of like, how could you improve memory? How could you use it for maintaining these things? So like, you know, I remember like studying in certain like locations, switching up the locations, studying for, you know, breaking up the study, all using all the things that you were, all of these behavioral, of these, I don't say behavioral studies, but like, you know, things like that. It was, and it, they, well, I don't want to say they worked, I, you know, causally, I don't know, but it did fine. I was impressed. Yeah. I was like, wow, I never thought I could remember this much. This is, but it had me thinking a lot about, yeah, just thinking, I think further related to that question of how much is memory constructive and in what ways, I think is like kind of the big question, it seems like, or one of the big empirical questions. And then in some ways like philosophical questions. But so up until this point, like what could you say a little bit about, and maybe this has changed, like the relationship between philosophers and then like the science and, you know, psychologists and neuroscientists as it relates to just like in their connection with one another, like, because I wasn't familiar with then the literature on folks just writing about, from a philosophy, I guess, from a philosophy of mind position, how did it maybe prior not necessarily interface as much with the science?
I mean, I think it's a great question. I mean, it's interesting to me sociologically that this is the case. I mean, I think especially because, you know, philosophy and like psychology and neuroscience have been, you know, there's so much work in conferences and organizational structures at that intersection. And it's somewhat surprising how little intersection there was on memory, given how much there is on everything else. Like both you think about like how much philosophy of perception there is as a field. And then that there's just tons of work of people doing things on forms of seeing and attending and other sensory processes and their relationships to philosophy. Like those fields are all like really nicely, they're a nice interdisciplinary, rich set, you know, like lots of people working there. And so like, why memory where there is this enormous, I mean, like if you were to base your philosophy of cognitive science on where the most cognitive science is happening, it'd be really strange for you to leave memory out.
Right.
Memory was for a really long time, just not, there weren't a lot of people doing that from the philosophy side. I mean, I think in some sense, because it was so big, because they didn't grow up to like, it is a very overwhelming kind of space to get in. There's kind of no way to get up to speed on the science of memory. It is, you know, it's massive.
That's like a little, sometimes I've found that issue where I might be very interested in a particular, because if, especially if you're in, you know, cognitive science or something like that, and then you get into it and you're like, this is going to take a long time to learn this, like to really well, like I was interested in like connectomics and like other kinds of like modeling factors. Yeah. And I realized this is going to take like a couple years maybe to like really say something, like it really can structure and dictate like what you decide to go into. So I could see maybe that being one explanation of something like that. Or, I mean, I'm sure there's other, you know, sociologically, other kinds of disciplinary things, but like, right, memory is so vast and so big and, you know, I don't know. Anyway. Okay. So, but now it sounds like things are connecting more so a little.
Very much so. So, I mean, there were some people, some of the early work, you know, so John Sutton, who was at Macquarie for a long time, was, you know, he wrote a book about memory traces in the late 90s. Christoph Hurl, along with the psychologist Teresa McCormick, they wrote a book about memory and time, like in the early 2000s. I think of both of those things now as these like kind of like empirically informed, you know, trying to put this stuff together, but that like, you know, there was no literature on on either of the things that those folks were doing. And it wasn't until there were a couple of us who were all finishing and working on memory at the same time. So Philippe de Brigard and me and Kirk and McCallion were all sort of around the same time starting to work on these things. And I think in those early days, there was, it was sort of hard to know. I mean, it has grown very rapidly. It went from like, there's like literally two other people writing on this broad range of topics in philosophy to like, oh, now there are just tons and tons. And so there was some stuff in epistemology and in stuff about personal identity on memory. So Sven Bernecker wrote a couple books about memory. But a lot of people were really thinking about, you know, kind of thinking about the way memory fits into standard problems. Like, you know, if you're worried about theories of knowledge, you know, not all your knowledge is occurring to you right now. So you got to put some of it in memory. So memory better work in a certain way. Or, you know, personal identity. One view says it's about, you know, retaining past iterations of yourself or being able to cast yourself backwards. And so memory is implicated a lot. So people would talk about it in those fields in terms of its implications, but no one was like, well, what is memory and what's interesting about memory itself? And that's really, I think, where the field has sort of taken off is, you know, asking those questions for its own sake in a way that's very science informed. So I think the virtue of it being a newer and more newly developing area is that, it's been kind of science, or I'd say at least, you know, naturalistically situated.
That's fair.
Yeah. While it's been kind of exploding.
Very, very cool. Very cool. Okay. All right. So focus. Okay. So, well, I'm happy to hear it. It's encouraging to hear a successful turn of, it's just interesting to me also the way in which folks, shifting gears early on. You know, you hear, the way in which, come to find the thing that's like really motivating and really interesting to us, and, or again, where we might have a success at making some really good contributions. I think that's really great. So, I can see like you have a very impressive resume, lots of publications, lots of different positions. So tell us a little bit about, we were also doing some biographical things. So what, after graduate school, how did you then, you know, approach professionally? What did you move on to do?
Yeah. So my first job out of grad school was, I was very fortunate to get a tenure track job in my first year on the job. I was in grad school for a long time. So for people who lose, I was in grad school for 8 years. So happens in a program where you take courses for a long time and then switch dissertation topics. But I think in some sense, I say this now from the perspective of being a DGS, that for philosophy especially, it takes a long time for your ideas to mature and for you to grow a sense of a field. As programs get their funding cut more and more and can only offer their grad students so much support, I think it really does hurt philosophy. Because I think I was advantaged in going on the job market by the fact that I'd had that long to think about things. So it was much easier to talk to people about how my work connected to theirs and how it connected to other areas, because I just had more time. And so I do think that was an advantage that I had. And memory was kind of new and exciting. So I could tell people a lot of stuff they didn't know and then connect it to stuff they did. So I felt like that had that really helped me out. So I got a tenure track job at the University of Texas, El Paso. I was very excited to move to the bright, sunny desert.
That's wonderful. Great. So had the experience at El Paso, but then I noticed, we kind of started the interview with this sort of, the experience with your family and kind of them sort of convincing you, or I told you so, about a potentially, the opportunity to kind of return home. So I don't want to say return home, but just like return to like a, you know, kind of a nearby region of sorts after being, in Missouri, in other places where, like, again, you never really expect as an academic necessarily to go back to like the origin spot.
Yeah. And I wasn't, I only ended up spending a year in El Paso, and that was in part, there were a lot of factors. And again, there's like so much like luck and privilege and even being able to frame it in this way, but there were lots of things I loved about that job and would have been happy to stay longer, but there weren't a lot of senior colleagues in the department and there wasn't a lot of mentorship. So I did, I felt a little at sea about how I was going to grow those aspects of things. It was also a university that was really changing and growing in some exciting ways. But that meant that there were a lot of potential demands on junior faculty to participate in these kind of university level initiatives in ways that finally getting time to sit down and write your papers alongside teaching and all these other things quite demanding. And so, the thought that maybe in a few years I'll be aiming to go someplace else was a thought that I had not terribly long after getting there, though I think I would have been happy there for a long time. And then a job came at the University of Kansas and in my area. And I thought I'm not going
to. Why not take it?
But I'm going to apply for that job because they have a philosopher of mind. They're not going to. So as soon as they find somebody and the person that they'd had for 40 years, my my predecessor was retired. He'd been there for 40 years. I was like, this is literally a once in every 40 years shot at this sort of thing. So, which was, you know, sort of how it was at the time. So I threw my hat in the ring for that and nothing else. And then left out. So I moved after a year to KU, and I've been here ever since. So
great. Wonderful. Well, great. Well, thank you. So I have a question. So you've studied memory a lot. What might be perhaps one or two things that are you found in your research to be the most surprising things that you found out about memory? Like things that, would be, you know, for individuals who, you know, maybe aren't necessarily, I mean, you could, if you want to share something that's more of a philosophy-based finding, but also just maybe in general, like, you know, that might just be experience for folks who are not, you know, might not be within our field, so to speak, and just thinking, what is kind of surprising that from your work in thinking about memory traces or engrams, as they've been referred to, is that like a neuroscience, more specifically like a neuroscience term, essentially?
The scientized, mechanized term
version of a trace.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I mean, I think my work and like my interest is sort of captivated by results on two ends, some of which we were talking about earlier. One is the sort of like just how malleable and constructive memory can be. So I think to the everyday person, I think it's hard for me now in the grips of all of that research to appreciate how many people don't have that view of memory. But our memories are they're easily distorted and manipulated in ways that it can feel to you like, no, that's definitely the person that I saw. And it isn't, or it is the person that you saw, but not in the context in which you think you saw them. And those things have huge implications, not just for like our interpersonal relationships and the way we testify to each other about stuff, but, you know, in social and political and criminal and legal contexts, as a lot of psychologists and neuroscientists have done work on, right? Those forms of manipulability and distortion are like, so those results are really striking to me, sort of how they're not easy in some respects, but they're easy in others. That we know very well what to do if we want you to misremember something. And then the other side of things, that like the ways in which our memories are good, is also really interesting to me. So the stuff you were saying about, you know, like learning these memory techniques, right? I'm also simultaneously fascinated by people who train for these memory championships and memorize 70,000 digits of pi, or they like, you know, can do all of these just incredible memory feats.
Trivia communities or whatever, like the quiz like, communities, stuff like that.
It can do that, and like there are memories I have from childhood, like some of them are, you know, of course distorted, or I've learned over time that, you know, you see the photo album and you're like, oh wow, that's funny, I, you know, mix these things together,
right?
But there are also things that we can hold distinctly and we can hold for a long time, and so thinking about you know, what's true about memory such that all of that is true at the same time is kind of...
That's interesting. Yeah.
That's sort of like what gets me out of bed in the morning, so to speak.
Wonderful. I have also interest. Is there like an ethics of memory division or something in terms of... So like for me, like I've just personally been thinking about questions like what is... maybe not the purpose of memory, but what do we owe to our memories? What do we owe in terms of a responsibility for preserving memories or preserving memories in the way, like, preserving the truthfulness of memories, or like, I don't know, just especially as like you get older and then maybe you realize like certain memories are fading, or I don't even know if you want to say fading, but like, sometimes I'm like, should I be like writing this down? Like, I mean, this is a very, you know, kind of folk consideration, but you know, as a philosopher or someone who studies this, I'm like, you know, do I have like, what are these kind of responsibilities to considering, you know, and not just like for historical purposes of this, but like just for personal, you know, just for like one's individual sense of like, you know, traveling through the world, like,
I mean, I think these are huge and important questions. To my knowledge, there are not many people working on the ethics of memory per se, at least not in the philosophy of memory community. There are a few things and a few pieces. Julia Driver has a lovely piece that I like about the harms involved in forgetting someone. that has always been a sort of inspiration for me. Allison Rehhild, who's a, if I'm saying her, I don't even know if I'm saying her name correctly. She's at Southern Illinois, Edwardsville, she has a really nice ethics of memory piece that I take to be like, from a few years ago, but where she's really kind of grappling with the question about like, if memory is reconstructive in all these ways, how should we think about a lot of ethical issues around that? And it strikes me as like, yeah, that could like kick off an entire field of concerns. I don't know that it has yet, but I hope that I hope that it does. But because I think a lot of these things are important, and the closest philosophers of memory have really gotten to that so far is in starting to think more about the nature of forgetting. And like, so if, I mean, right. One thing you might think is like, you can't hold someone responsible for remembering because you're like sort of not in charge of it in the right kind of way. But there is a lot of motivated and intentional forgetting actually. And so some people have been talking about those things more and kind of complicating that picture in ways that I think are going to be helpful for that conversation. But I'm always a big, like, more people doing this kind of stuff, you know, everybody join Philosophy of Memory. So you should think about this or encourage other people to. It'd be great to see it happen.
Oh, yeah. No, well, I mean, I've always held that. I've never thought of it as, I mean, you're convincing me slightly to like look into this. My field is more in philosophy of like psychiatry and things. But like, for example, like one of the, so there's some memory issues in PTSD, like things like flashbacks and like the way in which like trauma is remembered. And there's some fascinating sort of like examples whereby people will remember, you know, they'll have some sort of memory of a particular trauma. And then they'll, I mean, this is an example where they'll then be given some kind of new information and then they'll remember the trauma very differently. So it's like, and I'm sure that's it's like updated, but what I mean is like, or maybe it's more just like they're, I don't know if they'll remember the trauma differently, but their perception of the event or the relationship or something will change. Just a very quick example is like someone who presents for PTSD for bereavement, like a spouse has passed away of several years, and they having this, you know, sort of experience about this, and then later on they find out that the spouse was unfaithful. There's infidelity involved, and then all of a sudden, what do you mean? I like there's all of a sudden this like confabulation or like complete change of like I don't remember fondly this person, you know, because of the new information regarding the infidelity. That's like a very unique case. It's just one that happened to be shared as an anecdote from someone I spoke with, but I found it very fascinating to consider. Yeah, like what is, in what ways is this then, those kinds of things influencing? In what ways, I suppose, are these like maybe maladaptive things or maladaptive responses like trauma or things influencing memory and stuff like that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that relates to what I think is another big and it is studied empirically, but in a lot of different ways and not really taken up by philosophers much yet, which is the sort of relation between emotion and affect in memory. So how you think about this, there's so much to say there. Things have been said, but there's so much more to be said on all of this.
Fair enough. Well, we only have a little bit of time. Why don't you tell us about, what are your current projects, current research, anything you'd like to share about kind of what you're up to right now?
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about, I mean, someone who came from the cognitive side of things, I've been spending a lot of my time recently in the weeds of neurobiology. So as someone who was first interested in like false memory experiments and cognitive psychology, I got really interested when via techniques like optogenetics and chemogenetics, neurobiologists started making what looked like false memory paradigms in mice. And so I've been focusing a lot on how that research has kind of reinvigorated work around the notion of an engram, this idea that you could have a kind of detectable, identifiable memory mechanism for a particular memory. And so that idea is sort of back alive and central to a lot of stuff that's happening in neurobiology. So a lot of my work recently has been thinking about that concept, how it's changed over time, how it really relates to the cognitive work. So I've been working on a number of pieces in that regard. And in the background, I am working on somewhat perpetually at this point, on a book that has to do with the notion of a memory trace, and sort of giving a kind of theory of what that actually is that makes sense of what contemporary neurobiology is doing. That's the... that's the aim.
Fantastic. All right. Well, yeah. that's we're looking forward to that and understanding this. So, and it sounds like I should mention, so you mentioned you are the DGS at the at Kansas, where you do have MA and PhD programs in philosophy. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Okay. Well, just, yeah, I'm always interested and familiar with and encouraging other. Is that something where you're taking applicants at this time or and things
are,
like that?
Yeah. So we, yeah. So January 5th is our application deadline. And yeah, we have, I think we have a really positive and good grad community. So yeah, anyone who listens to this should definitely think about putting us on our on their list. So
wonderful. Okay. Well, why don't we conclude with the last question? What do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
Yeah, I was trying to think of an answer to that before I realized that I was off by an hour.
Fair enough.
I was like, oh, there went the 20 minutes. I was going to try to figure
come
out
come up with something. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, one thing I think is true, which I think is a virtue of, I mean, it's a virtue and then a problem for philosophy of science, is that, you know, I support and like and am a product of the idea that philosophy of science now is more like the philosophy of the sciences, right? So there's not a kind of like, here's the issue of explanation as it applies everywhere. Here's the issue of realism as it applies everywhere. You know, we're sort of realizing that you should take particular sciences or forms of scientific inquiry on their own merits and look at them individually, which shows that they're different, also allows time to give attention to other sciences that don't always get that attention, like psychiatry or archaeology or, you know, like so many interesting areas of study. And so I think, yeah, so I think at least one of the great challenges is like keeping the philosophy of science together while all of that happens, right? So
yeah.
In the same way that, yeah, so like making sure that there's still spaces and issues and connections that are kind of cross sub, you know, field disciplinary as those things happen. I think that, if not the greatest challenge, a very important
it's one. A big one. It's a big one. Yeah. I would interpret this as like the hyper specialization. But the way you put it brings to me also then questions of like, so what is, what is our goal of sort of keeping things? This, what are some of the consequences if we're not unable to keep things together, or what are some of the benefits of keeping this together? Like, yeah. Especially if we're, you know, more interested in like, you know, developing these little pockets of, you know, good philosophical questions, not necessarily in service of the science, but in service of broader all these other kind of rules. Is there something, it's not necessarily to bring back to add to the, you know, understanding of the philosophy of science, what are some good reasons why we would?
Yeah. So, I mean, on that hyper specialization point, I think in the same way that part of what philosophy of science is doing for science now is that because it got so hyper specialized, you know, there are people working in memory research, you know, who don't know that there's other people doing that. You know, there's some neurobiologists and some cognitive psychologists that I take to be speaking to really similar things. And they have no idea the others, you know, like there's just no incentive or even it's not clear what it would take for them to even much know about or understand each other's work. So I take some of the work that we philosophers are doing to be really important in that sense of providing a framework to put that stuff together. And I worry that like, we're going to follow suit and someday it's going to be like, well, the philosophers of archaeology are doing this really interesting thing. And the people thinking about the nature of chemistry, you know, are doing this other interesting thing. And we're not going to be able to kind of put those into conversation with each other anymore. That kind of broader perspective, we could lose something by not thinking about, you start to take for granted what focuses only in your area.
Definitely. That fair enough. No, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. All right. Well, Sarah, Dr. Robbins, I really appreciate you taking the time. I had a lot of fun. Thank you again. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And yeah, I think this was really nice.
This was really, it was very lovely. I appreciate the invitation and the service of doing this kind of a podcast. I think this is a really, it's a great service to the profession. So thanks for doing it.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Well, best of luck. Enjoy the remainder of your Friday. And yeah, we'll be in touch soon. Are you happy to go to the PSA by chance?
I am.
Okay.
There'll be a memory symposium I'll be a part
okay.
of.
I'm planning to flirt with pluralism. What's that?
I'm going to flirt with pluralism about
Wonderful. Ooh, fun. Okay. Well, enjoy the rest of your Friday. I'll be sure to say hello at the PSA if I can make it to the memory workshop. So
that sounds great.
Thanks. Take care.